In 1990, the death of a Missouri woman by the name of Nancy Cruzan ended a legal battle that captivated a nation. Although the ethical debates had just begun, Nancy was 25 years old when a car accident left her in a persistent vegetative state, that's the medical terminology, with no hope of regaining normal functioning. Her family wanted to remove her feeding tubes, but the hospital refused, and the Missouri Supreme Court upheld that decision. The case ended up going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Myra Christopher of the Kansas City-based Center for Practical Bioethics was there. She also helped draft the legislation that came out of it. Before that moment, there wasn't this talk we hear so much of these days about advanced directives and living wills. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And as Myra Christopher prepares to accept a Lifetime Achievement Award from a national bioethics organization, we're going to hear what it's been like to spend decades at the center of this debate on dignity and death. Myra Christopher, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So first of all, you know, I am going to start with this Cruzan case, but then I want to hear more about you and your life. In 1990, a Kansas City Star article boldly proclaimed that because of the Nancy Cruzan case, discussions about life support and medical treatment moved from doctor's circles to dinner tables. Do you think that's true?
I think that's true in large part. I do, because it was such a highly publicized tragedy, really. And so people all over the country were talking about this case.
What do younger listeners in particular who may not remember the whole thing, which was huge nationally and locally, need to understand about how end-of-life issues were handled by hospitals and physicians and families
right
before Nancy Cruzan?
Well, and what I would say to younger listeners is to remind them of her age, because we all often think that these conversations are about frail people, old people, people who are terminally ill. And they're really not. They're really about the fact that life is fragile and none of us knows from day to day what our futures will be. But the situation is hard for some people to imagine today. But at that point, we had had this sort of explosion of biomedical technology. And for the first time in the history of mankind, we could literally sustain bodily function all but indefinitely. It was not clear, it was not at all certain as to whether or not adults had the right to refuse treatment, life-sustaining treatment, even ordinary, everyday sort of treatment, or whether refusing life-sustaining treatment was tantamount to suicide. And at that point in our country, almost every state had a law against suicide. I've always been amused by those thinking, and what would the punishment be for one who committed suicide? But it was really very unclear. And physicians were very concerned that were they to allow a patient to refuse treatment or a family member to refuse for someone who was without capacity, would they in fact be committing murder or manslaughter? So it was a very uncertain time. A lot of capacity, a lot of uncertainty, legally, ethically, and medically.
When you say a lot of capacity, what do you mean? Just the technological?
The technological capacity. A mm-hmm. lot of medical, clinical capacity. So you had this clash of two institutions, really three, because certainly those of us who are concerned and focused on morals and ethics were certainly very, very attentive to this case as well.
So take me back to that moment where the nation is first grappling with these issues and the different arguments that people were making.
Right. Well, I will take you back to the first moment that I got involved in this case. And I got a call one day from a young attorney here in Kansas City. He was at Sicardi & Bacon. And he told me that he was doing a little pro bono guardianship case down in southern Missouri, and it involved a young woman who was in a persistent vegetative state. Now, that was a fairly new clinical diagnosis. A task force on vegetative state had only published her findings, I think, a couple of years before that.
What does that phrase mean exactly?
That means that a person has permanently lost consciousness. It's really frontal lobe, frontal brain activity where people never have, again, a memory, a hope, an expectation, a fear, but they maintain some bodily function. In Nancy's situation, she had lost the swallow reflex. There are other cases where people lose the ability to breathe without ventilatory support and so forth. So this young attorney called me and asked me if I knew anything about persistent vegetative state. And I said I did. This task force had recently published their findings. And there was a lot of writing going on at that point in bioethics about what should we do with these patients. So he asked me, could I get that information to him? And I said, I would gladly do that. I will mail it to you. And he said, no. Do you have a fax? And this was so long ago, I didn't even have a fax. And I said, no, I do not. So he said to me, could you possibly, if I send a taxi cab, would you make copies of those articles and give them to the driver and let him bring them back? And I said, certainly. So this young man's name was Bill Colby. And eventually, Bill Colby is now a longtime friend and a colleague. At one point, he worked at the Bioethics Center following all of this. But at the end of the conversation, I said, Colby, what's this kid's name? And he said, her name is Nancy Beth Cruzan. I could never have imagined how that phone call would impact what was then Midwest Bioethics Center, now the Center for Practical Bioethics, how it would impact me personally, professionally at that point. But it really was one of those events that was just kind of unforeseeable in your personal and professional life that was really a turning point.
You know, you said that you couldn't foresee how this would affect you personally and professionally. Start with the personal part.
Well, I had been interested in end-of-life issues, really end-of-life care decision-making, which was at the heart of this case, was what drove me as a young adult to go back to school and to study bioethics. Events related to the death and dying of the dying and the death of my mother, who died in our home at age 53. I had had, Gina, for this always sounds a little weird when I tell this, but my life, although I was in my late 20s when my mother was diagnosed,
Diagnosed with what?
She had a rare stomach cancer. And my life had been sort of peppered with the deaths of people very close to me. My grandmother had died when I was 10. She was the person who probably most shaped my values and worldview. My very best friend died of bone cancer when we were sophomores in high school. She was diagnosed when we were in the eighth grade. My only female cousin died when we were in our early 20s, and then my mother's death. So my life
really
had been
a lot.
It is a lot. And I still meet people, even my age, who say, you know, I've never experienced a personal loss. And I think, wow, you live in a much different universe than do I. But I had been very, very interested in how decisions were made, who held power, why they held power, on what grounds were those decisions made, what kind of facts were involved in the case.
What was it about your personal experience, if you don't mind my asking, that had made you curious about those particular issues? Had you experienced firsthand some of these questions of power and who has a say?
I think in large part, I mentioned the death of my best friend when we were about teenagers. She was diagnosed with bone cancer. And she had been having problems with her shoulder and her arm for several months. And she went to the hospital, quote unquote, for some test. And she woke up the next morning having had a radical amputation above her shoulder. And the reason that she was not told what was going to happen was because at that point, we would have been 13, I think, when that happened. It was believed that children shouldn't be involved in those kinds of decisions. And as her illness progressed and it was clear that she was losing the battle, her parents could never speak with her. And her parents were wonderful people. Her mom was my bluebird leader, so they were such good people. But they just couldn't bring themselves to do it. So for 2 years after school, every day, I would go sit with Susan and her homework if she had not been able to go to school. And we would talk about the fact that she was so ill and she knew she was dying. And we would talk about what she wanted, where she wanted her funeral, where she wanted to be buried, what she wanted to wear, what she wanted to be done with her charm bracelet.
This is when you were 13, you were having these conversations?
13 to 15.
Man.
So the week before Susan died, her parents just insisted, and she acquiesced because she wanted so much for them to be okay with what was going on. They insisted that she have another round of chemotherapy. And so she spent her last few days in the hospital, and then it was the case that she planned to go back to school one day, and when I went to pick her up and carpool, her mom said, "Susan's too ill." And when I got to school, I had a message from my mom, "You need to call home. You need to come home." And she had died in that interval. So from early teen years, I was deeply disturbed about why she was not engaged in this conversation. And then when, you know, fast forward like 15 years, and now my mom is going through very similar experiences, and she is an adult and with full capacity, it's still the case that we're not always given full information, and that it's assumed that certain courses of treatment will apply without her being involved in that decision at all. Or I remember a day that we left the hospital, quote-unquote AMA, against medical advice, because she wanted to leave the hospital. And when we got back to the hospital, a young physician was just in a rage and said to me, "Did you not know that you could have killed your mother?" And my mother said to him, at that point probably weighing 75 pounds and sitting in a wheelchair, she said to him, "You poor little fool, did you not know that I was dying and I wanted to go home for a while?" So much of my life had been focused on these kinds of issues. So when Mom died, it was right after Kubler-Ross had published on death and dying. It was shortly after that. And I thought, well, you know, things are kind of out of sync here. I was a stay-at-home mom, professional volunteer. And I thought, I'll just go back over to the university and take a course in the psych of death and dying, study Kubler-Ross's book, and see if that doesn't help me process some of this.
So you were wanting to process things personally.
My personal experience.
Not restart a new career.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no, never.
Least of all, a new career taking you to the U.S. Supreme Court.
No, no, no. I had a wonderful life. I was one of those blessed in our society to be a stay-at-home mom and be a community volunteer and to pretty much do what I wanted to do. So I found that I hated the psych of death and dying, and frankly, I think Kubler-Ross did a great service by calling our attention to this issue, but I think it's pretty well understood now, and I knew then she got it all wrong.
What did she get wrong?
Well, her book purported that there is this progression to death and dying, that there is this, you know, at first you're shocked, and then you're angry, and then you move through these different phases you do. Pre-grieving, and you come to acceptance. Well, in my life and in the context of my family and friends, we didn't do things nearly that orderly. We kind of moved in and out of those spaces, and we weren't always in sync with one another. So I hated this course, and I wasn't very fond of the professor either. I kept bugging her, and finally she said to me, "There is a philosopher on campus by the name of Hans Uffelmann, who I think you should go and talk with." Because Hans was one of the first philosophers in the United States to have an appointment, an academic appointment, in a medical school here at UMKC. So I did that, and I ended up studying with Hans and working with Hans, teaching with him.
But did this help you process things personally?
The psych of death and dying course?
And just this whole academic path you started down.
Well, the first academic experience, being back in school. I had gone to school out of high school, gone to college. It was frustrating. It just made things worse for me because I thought these people don't know what they're talking about, you know. So when I met Hans, who really was a pioneer in the field of bioethics, I found great comfort. In fact, the very first course I took from him, I will never forget the first day. He presented a case study of a young man with lymphoma, I believe was the diagnosis, in his late 20s. So a young man about the age that I was at that point. I guess I was 30 by then. And his parents did not want him to be told his diagnosis. And his wife, of only a few months, was insistent that he be told the truth. Neither party was malintended. The wife wanted him to have the information so they could plan their life together and move forward. The parents wanted him protected from that information because they believed it would take away his will to fight. It would take away his will to live. So that very day, and the question to the class was, you know, who's right here and who's wrong here, and how would you make those judgments? And I thought, wow, this is the place I need to be. And so I was for about 7 years.
So you have this moment where you're called by an attorney in town, and you've become this leader in the area, and he's asking you for articles on the ethics around end-of-life issues. He wants them sent to him in a taxi cab because right. We cannot yet just email that over or right. Whatever. How did that moment stir some of this back up? Did it?
Well, my day-to-day work really has been always around these issues. The Bioethics Center addresses all kinds of issues, everything from issues related to the Human Genome Project or to personalized medicine to all kinds of research issues and so forth. But my work has focused on, until just the last few years, focused almost exclusively on end-of-life issues. So what was surprising to me about it was, as the case then became more and more public, how it impacted our work. And just as an example, you know, again, we were this startup, not-for-profit. We had a Radio Shack phone with three lines on it. So when the case would be public, we would just be inundated with calls. And there was one occasion when the decisions was made, and there were multiple legal decisions along the ways, that we worked, we were a very small staff. There were six or seven of us at that point. We worked shifts, and we worked three shifts a day. We worked around the clock because our little telephone and our little voice recorder could not keep up with the volume of calls.
Who was calling? Why were the phones ringing off the hook? Just to remind people, we're talking about the Nancy Cruzan case.
Because people were afraid. And actually, after the Patient Self-Determination Act, which you referenced earlier, was drafted and approved in Congress, Senators Danforth and Moynihan it was a bipartisan piece of legislation, had invited those of us who worked with it to be in the Senate and to attend a press conference thereafter. And Senator Danforth, who I think is just an amazing human being, told me, you have 1 minute, so you know, choose what you want to say very carefully. And I told a story about one of those calls, that I had a call from an elderly woman in Missouri who said, I'm calling because I want one of those living will documents. We don't really talk about living wills very much anymore. We talk about health treatment directives. But she said, I am afraid I will never be dead enough to be buried in Missouri. There is a whole underpinning of politics around conservative politics that made this worse, that exacerbated this tragic situation. So that was the story I told in the minute I had. People were afraid.
Do you, you know, you were involved in the drafting of the Patient Self-Determination Act. That's right. What you're telling us about now. And it was a bipartisan effort. You were, in fact, brought into it by Senator Danforth from
Correct.
Missouri, who is
mm-hmm.
a Republican.
Correct.
And is it interesting to you to see how conversations around this both evolve in that, you know, advanced directives and thinking about these things and talking about them among families and documenting your wishes before it's an issue? That is such a part of our culture now, and hospitals and physicians will ask you questions about that even if you haven't already had those conversations, which is part of the Patient Self-Determination Act, that they are required to do that. Is it interesting to you, though, to see that at the same time, the sort of fundamental questions, those do not go away, and they don't exit the political arena?
Those questions will never go away because they are fundamental questions about human existence. Who am I? Why am I here? What does any of this mean? What will my death mean? You know, I think it is interesting, Gina, your perception of this is interesting to me. Because prior to all of this, we had started a project here in Kansas City with the Med Society, MetroMed, the local bar association, and the Bioethics Center, and for the purpose of educating people in our community about the need to talk about these issues, to make living wills. Again, that was the instrument we talked about then. And we had trained about 300 volunteers and had done more than 1,000 educational programs in Kansas City. Danforth called and said, I know about this project, which we believe to be the first community-based project focused on this in the country. Do you think you could replicate it nationally? Now, and we said, yes, of course. So at that point, the University of Chicago had done a national survey, which indicated that about a third of the adults in the United States said they had had these conversations and they had made a living will. Now, I never have known what that meant to those people at that point. Interestingly, the data are not a lot different now than they were then. There's certainly, as you imply, much more awareness. It's much more a public conversation. But the act of actually completing a health directive after talking with someone you would choose to be your surrogate decision maker in the event you can't decide for yourself has not increased very much at all.
Well, and I hope you'll forgive me saying so. That doesn't actually surprise me because it's hard. You know, people are in their day-to-day lives. It never really feels like the day in the absence of some imminent cause for concern.
Right.
Even if you recognize the importance of it, it never really feels like a great day to sit down with someone and say, I've been thinking about what happens if worst case scenario after worst case scenario, even if you're ready to have that conversation, it's very scary to approach
right.
someone else with
right.
it.
And that's what people often say to me, other scholars and people working in this space. But here's the way I try to reframe this conversation. What you're really referring to is our avoidance of death, the death taboo in our society. But I say to people all the time, if you have a kid going off to college, you better sit down and have this conversation. Because unless he or she names you their durable power of attorney for healthcare decision making, should they lose capacity, be in a car accident or have a brain bleed or things that happen to young people, the clinic at the college, the health center, would not be able to share their medical information without you because he or she is now an adult and HIPAA protects their right to privacy. I also say to people, you know, many of us don't ever make a will, a real will, not a living will, but a will for the event of our death until we have children. And then we think, wow, you know, we need to do this because it's the thing responsible adults do. And I would argue the very same thing is true about this. These conversations are not nearly as difficult to have as people think they are. And we've done a lot of work in trying to figure out how to help people have those conversations. So don't start out asking your mom or dad, hey, do you want to be on a ventilator? You would start out by saying, Mom and Dad, you know, I want to know in the event that I become your decision maker, what's important to you? I want to know what's made your life joyful and what's concerned you.
Myra Christopher, hang on with me for just a minute through this break, okay? We are going to come right back to talk about Myra Christopher's career, including her current work on the issue of pain. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Myra Christopher, whose life work for the Center for Practical Bioethics here in Kansas City is being recognized next week by a national conference. We've heard about her decades of work on end-of-life care and the politics surrounding it, in addition to the ethics and the emotions. And Myra, you've taken a little bit of a pivot lately. It's connected, but a little different. What are you passionate about right now?
It is connected. My work now almost exclusively focuses on chronic pain. And Gina, about 15 years ago, I was running a national program for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where we were able to make $11.25 million in grant awards to states who were willing to work on issues like we were just talking about, not exclusively advanced care planning. Also looking at the need for better education of our healthcare professionals about these issues, involvement of clergy and addressing the spiritual aspect of these matters, but also pain. And as part of running a program for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, you're expected to create a national advisory committee. And pain was the area that I really knew the least about professionally. When my mother had experienced her dying, we had struggled and struggled and struggled to manage her pain and never did. We're very unsuccessful with that. So I reached out to a scholar at the University of Wisconsin who had started a pain and policy studies group there. And when I asked him to help me by joining this advisory committee, he told me no, that he believed that an unintended consequence of the palliative care movement, which is a big name.
You're putting that in air quotes.
For the end of life care movement, would have an unintended consequence of making life more difficult for those who lived with chronic pain. I did not understand that.
Yeah, on the face of it, it's a little counterintuitive.
Yeah, I thought it was too, because I felt that the end of life was kind of the moral high ground, and if we could get pain managed there, it would trickle down, and we would do a better job of managing pain, period.
Can you explain that?
I can. There are different kinds of pain. There's acute pain. Most of us know that. You've broken a bone. You've had a baby. You've had a toothache. There is terminal pain, which was what my mother had experienced. And then there is chronic pain. Chronic pain is a neurologic disease, and it is a problem that occurs when pain is not addressed appropriately. It goes on for a period of time, and the brain literally, the nervous system literally, repatterns around the pain response. People look quizzically at me, and I try to shortcut that conversation by saying most of us accept phantom limb pain syndrome, where perhaps a veteran has lost a limb. The arm is gone or the leg is gone, but they continue to have terrible pain as though that arm were there. That's chronic pain. And many people have it, not because of an amputation, but because of post-surgical pain. Or trauma, pain associated with trauma, or pain associated with disease. Cancer treatment even can lead to chronic pain, and often does, actually. So I told my colleague that if he would help me, I would try to help him with his work, and I would certainly try to learn everything I could about that. And I tried to be faithful to that. In that process, I have come to believe, and I think many people find this hard to accept, but that chronic pain, Albert Schweitzer said, is an even more evil lord over mankind than is death itself. Those who are dying, those who are living with terminal pain, know that an end will come. Relief is in sight. Those who live with chronic pain have no such notion. They have no reason to believe that. And frankly, chronic pain is it's the major cause of disability in the United States. It is a major cause, we're trying to define how significantly, of suicide in the United States. And the younger the person is living with chronic pain, the more likely he or she is to commit suicide. So, you know, I'm not a clinician. My background's in philosophy. I'm a community organizer. I felt at that point, and I feel now, that I was blessed to be part of launching a palliative care, end-of-life care movement in this country. And I wanted to see if I could transfer that experience to try to do something similar about chronic pain. It has been much harder work than the end-of-life care.
That is really interesting because death, I mean, is both emotionally and politically, I mean, one of the most charged things you can imagine. And managing pain, it seems like, would be something that people would generally agree on, that you want
less pain equals good. Wouldn't you think? But actually, there are parallels between both of these situations, because we mentioned the taboo against talking about death. Our socialization and enculturation, this is a generalization, obviously, is that pain is bad and that it is visited upon those who deserve it and or those who are weak, have strength or character.
I'm sure interested in how you came to this notion, because I believe that we hold all sorts of ideas in our hearts that mm-hmm. we don't recognize, mm-hmm. but I think most of us would not accept that we believe that pain is visited upon those who deserve it.
Okay, so those who have children, I'm sure at some point have said to them, oh, don't cry, don't whine, buck up. Oh, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Brush it off, get back in the game, and so forth. We're also, some people are taught in religious education that pain is redemptive. Penny Ziegler, who was formerly a president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, said to me one time, the real problem here is that we are Puritans from our core out. We believe that those who live with pain deserve to live with pain. So if you look at this situation, first of all, that's one analogy, that we're culturally educated and socialized that if you're just strong enough or good enough, pain would go away. Another parallel is that our doctors are not taught how to address this issue. In the United States, this is according to NIH, the average physician has about 8 hours in their entire training on addressing pain, although it is the number one reason that people see a doctor. Canada's a little better. It's 11 hours, but I'm always struck by the fact that our veterinarians get 87 hours.
Is pain
training.
This might sound like a really dumb question, but is pain, are there doctors who specialize in pain?
Yes,
is that a specialty?
There are. There are board certified physicians. It's a subspecialty. They are certified through anesthesiology, which I will make some enemies when I say this, but that in itself is problematic because we have never established chronic pain management as a specialty in its own right. And so anesthesiologists who do interventional procedures, steroid injections, nerve blocks, Coxcomb injections, those kinds of things. Well, actually, I guess it's orthopedic surgeons who are doing Coxcomb injections. But those kinds of things are the ones who are board certified. Those things are helpful to some patients. They are very expensive, and they are not helpful to many patients. What we are advocating for is comprehensive chronic pain care. Chronic pain, and again, it's a neurologic disease, but it is a biopsychosocial problem.
You said that you were hoping to use your experience mm-hmm. in launching the end of life movement in the United States mm-hmm. to translate that to working with chronic pain.
Correct.
Are there any ways that tell me where the parallel is helpful to you and where it breaks down, where you don't see a path based on your experience?
The parallel is helpful to me in that I realize I know that this is worthy work and that a lot of people are suffering needlessly and that we can do better. So it's a motivator to me in a sense. The politics of this are much nastier than are the end of life, were the end of life politics, and still are to some degree.
Well, how so?
Well, euthanasia, we want to talk about, we can call it all kinds of things, mercy killing, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, aid in dying. That was a big problem while we were trying to get the end-of-life care movement going. I mean, good Lord, what is his name? The physician from Michigan who kept euthanizing people.
Kevorkian?
Kevorkian, thank you. A senior moment there. Kevorkian and all of that was a huge problem in the movement to improve end-of-life care. But he did not hold a candle to the problems that we see associated with the opioid epidemic. So let me say this. I'm very concerned about the opioid epidemic. It's a huge issue. There is not a causal connection between efforts to improve chronic pain care and the opioid epidemic. There's clearly a corollary. But since 2010, we have seen a decline in opioid prescribing as we're promoting more comprehensive care. We continue to see the addiction rate increase. So in the media, with no offense, Gina.
None taken.
The media has been in a feeding frenzy around the opioid epidemic, and that was not the case with regard to, well, maybe it was with Kevorkian, but Kevorkian was kind of a flash in the pan, really.
Well, you know, we don't have much time left, and I want to bring this back to your story, which we've talked about that your early experiences with death after death really set the stage for your life's work. As you've worked through the issue in the political arena and in the academic arena and on the policy level and with hospital administration, in the medical field, has that helped you work through it inside yourself in your own life?
You know, my father would say I'm the most hard-headed person you ever met in your whole life. But I was also blessed to be raised by parents and in a family context where principles mattered. My dad would say there's nobody in the middle of the road but dead armadillos and guys with yellow streaks up their back. So figure out what you think about this and try to do something to make it better. Both experiences have been incredibly frustrating. The end-of-life experience has been enormously gratifying, but I pray, I hope, that given time, the work I'm doing in chronic pain will be as well.
Myra Christopher, congratulations on your Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Center for Bioethics and Humanities.
Thank you. It's a great honor. It's an honor to be here with you today, Gina.
For me as well. Well, up next, why a really old bug has a KU scientist feeling giddy. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now we are talking about the whirligig beetle, which perhaps you have not heard of. That's because nobody had really heard of it until fairly recently. We're going to be talking about this bug with Greg Gustafson, a postdoctoral research fellow in ecology and evolutionary biology at KU. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Why is the whirligig beetle, which I can't believe I tripped over it because I actually think it's one of the most fun kinds of bugs to say.
Yeah.
But why does this bug matter?
Well, so if we're specifically talking about this whirligig beetle from Madagascar, it matters because it changes our perspective on how animals are originating on the island or how they got there.
And this island's location makes it of particular interest to scientists, right?
Yeah, that's true. Madagascar is a very interesting place because if you were to go back about 180 million years ago when the continents were together in the supercontinent Pangaea, Madagascar was smack dab in the middle of sort of the southern portion of this in what's called Gondwana. And so as those began to break up, Madagascar experienced extensive isolation.
And so Madagascar is both isolated, so that would be like, the islands where Darwin found canaries who had been kind of off in isolation, right?
Yeah, the Galapagos. I think probably a more comparable example for Madagascar might be New Zealand. So, and we compare sort of this whirligig beetle that studied to one of the animals they have there called the tuatara. And so the tuatara is interesting because it's believed that New Zealand was isolated for a long period of time as well following the breakup of Gondwana. And this reptile was able to survive there because it had been isolated while its relatives went extinct on the mainland.
Can I just say that Gondwana sounds like something out of fantasy fiction?
Yeah, it has a very interesting name.
But so it's not just the isolation, though, right? It's that this would have also theoretically connected two different land masses that we think of as having different animal life, but that people were, right, looking for some kind of connection in the creatures of Madagascar.
Yeah, so when this idea that the continents were all combined at one time in Gondwana, it had some significant implications because it meant that species could be distributed there and on, say, for example, Africa or India. And as the continents began to separate around, so Africa separated from Madagascar, Antarctica, Australia, India and Madagascar around 160 million years ago. So as that happened, you had Africa sort of drifting away. And then about 90 million years ago, you had Madagascar and India separate. And following that time, Madagascar was all by itself from 90 million years on. It was isolated. And so scientists initially thought that it would have taken some animals with it. These ancient lineages would have been isolated on Madagascar. And when we started looking at the vertebrate species, so we now have molecular data. We can use the molecular clock to sort of get an idea for how long lineages have been evolving and diverging from one another in living things that don't necessarily have fossils.
Molecular clock is a term I've never heard before.
Yeah, it's this idea that silent mutations that don't necessarily have a negative attribute accumulate in a clock-like manner in animals' DNA. And the idea is that the amount of...
A clock, so I don't know. I don't think of clocks as accumulating unless you're talking about like a stopwatch or something.
Kind of. So it's slowly, as time proceeds, the idea is you slowly accumulate these mutations. And the amount of these mutations that you see can tell you for how long things have been evolving independent from their relatives.
And so this all comes back to the whirligig beetle. How?
So going back to this idea that researchers were expecting to find these really ancient lineages on Madagascar. And of course, they had started looking with some of the larger, more charismatic species.
More charismatic.
Yeah, like lemurs, the fuzzy things. Lemurs, tenrics, and there's a unique carnivore fauna there. And they were finding that these lineages weren't really that ancient. So using molecular estimates, we were finding that they probably arrived on the island around 60 million years ago, and they probably rafted there from Africa.
Rafted?
Well, that's the current idea. It was published in Nature. It's very popular. A mass of mainland Africa ripped off and sort of floated to Madagascar carrying lemurs with it.
And other charismatic animals.
Other charismatic animals, yeah. And so what makes this discovery really special was if you were to travel back in time to the Mesozoic, to the age of the dinosaurs, you would find that the whirligig beetles were the dominant whirligig beetles at the time were the relative of this thing known from Madagascar. And the age of this group is such that it dates back to that time when all the continents were together. So as time proceeded, you had these relatives of the striped whirligig beetle the Cretaceous mass extinction event occurred, right? And most of them went extinct. However, we still have one alive today on Madagascar. And it may be that
one strain of them, or like you're not saying like one actual beetle.
We have one species.
One species.
So there is one species that is the ancestor of this once dominant lineage.
And it's not very charismatic?
Oh, for a whirligig beetle, it's very charismatic.
Tell me about it.
We call it the Malagasy striped whirligig because it has this yellow and black striped patterning it's the only species that has yellow and black stripes. So it's very charismatic compared to most that are usually dark colored like black.
How did you get involved in all of this?
Well, so my PhD dissertation was done on whirligig beetle systematics. So studying...
Can I stop and say, how long is a PhD dissertation?
How long? Like,
yeah.
In terms of time?
Like pages.
Pages? Well, mine was rather long, so I did a major monographic revision of this genus of whirligig beetle from Southeast Asia. So mine was over 100 pages.
It
was
on the whirligig beetle.
All on whirligig beetles.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, so I'm trying to remember where I was at last.
Yeah, how you got involved in this discovery.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that we were lacking in terms of knowledge about whirligig beetles was we didn't have an idea for the timing and sort of tempo of the evolution of this group. We weren't sure exactly how old they were or when certain major lineages started to evolve and become diverse.
How did you get so interested in beetles in the first place?
Well, I've liked them since I was a little kid, but I didn't really know I could have a career just looking at them and studying how they're related to one another until I was an undergraduate student at the University of Kansas. And I volunteered in the lab of a systematic entomologist named Dr. Andrew Short.
What was it that you saw in that lab or noticed that really made you say, not only did I like looking at beetles as a kid, but there's really something to explore here?
Well, I remember exactly what it was about whirligig beetles. So Dr. Short had been working on a survey of the aquatic beetles of Venezuela, and I was mounting some of the insect material he'd collected, and I was looking at some of the specimens, and one caught my eye in particular. It was the most wild thing I'd ever seen. It had seemingly four eyes, and then it had these strange paddle-like middle and hind legs, while the front legs remained long and raptorial for grabbing things.
Raptorial?
Yeah, so they reach out and grab things. Whirligig beetles are, they live on the surface of water, and they feed on insects that have become trapped there. So they swim up to them, and they have these elongate arms that they reach out and grab their prey with.
What did you wonder about them?
Well, it was the coolest animal I've ever seen. I wanted to know what other sort of whirligig beetles there were in the world. How did they evolve to be so unique? And when I asked Dr. Short, I was like, does anybody work on these right now? And he goes, no, currently there is no expert. So I decided that that person would be me.
Man, so when this moment comes where someone is reaching out to you about that there is a species of whirligig beetle on Madagascar that like has developed in isolation going back to when there was a landmass unified that no longer exists. Like, was this sort of like, oh my God, this is my moment?
Yes, I thought that this was a very huge moment because our current understanding of Madagascar, there is no lineage that's endemic, so found nowhere else except for on Madagascar, that dates back to over 200 million years. So it was relatively unheard of. And as we looked at the fossil record, it revealed this very interesting story. So as I mentioned earlier, during the age of dinosaurs, the relatives of the striped whirligig beetle, if we look at the fossils, they were the dominant whirligig beetles. And you see that after this end Cretaceous mass extinction event, the fossils disappear. So we stop seeing them. Seemingly, they've gone extinct. And then we see the modern whirligig beetles that are dominant today. So if you were to go out into ponds or streams here in Missouri and Kansas, you would find a group of whirligig beetles that belong to a group we call the gyrinines. And so these gyrinines replaced the relatives of the striped whirligig beetle everywhere else. But it turns out that one lineage was able to survive on Madagascar. And while we can't say exactly when it arrived on Madagascar, we can say that this lineage is old enough that it could have been there the entire time, and that as those continents broke up, they took the last surviving lineage with it, and it was able to survive because it was isolated from the gyrinines as they rose to power. Because
every single proper name you are using today is insane. Gyrinines?
That's unfortunately, this is one of the things we really struggle with when we work on invertebrates. Is unlike dogs or cats, they don't really have common names. So that's what we have to work with.
As we go out, I mean, does this discovery say something to us about life that goes beyond whirligig beetles?
Yeah, so one of the things we really tried to emphasize was that whirligig beetles weren't alone in being these really ancient lineages. And so perhaps as more people approach and pay attention to the invertebrates, the smaller life forms, we'll learn more about the world around us.
Greg Gustafson, thank you so much for telling us this story today.
Thank you for having me.
Gray is a postdoctoral research fellow in ecology and evolutionary biology at KU. He's been talking to us about the whirligig beetle of Madagascar and how he became the expert in whirligig beetles, period. You can listen back to this conversation and our chat with Myra Christopher, a bioethicist, at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also grab our food show online. There's a list of new restaurants to check out. Our critics reviewed lots of exciting new additions to the food scene. kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.